This part of our programming is supported by Radiant Engineering of Bozeman, providers of Radiant Floor Heating System kits, components, and professional support for do-it-yourselfers. Phone 406-587-3442.
From studios at MSU Billings, this is KEMC. And from Bozeman, KBMC, KYPR Gillette, and KECC Miles City.
This part of our programming is supported by Glenn Borkenhagen of Inland GPS, providing Trimble GPS equipment for surveying and mapping professionals in Montana and Wyoming from headquarters in Cody, Wyoming.
Good evening from Sissel Recital Hall at Montana State University, Billings. We're here tonight to talk about comprehensive education about sexuality in our schools. And we'll get to that program in just a moment. I do want to call your attention to the fact that the next program that Yellowstone Public Radio will hold in this hall will be National Public Radio Senior Correspondent Juan Williams on the 27th of May. He is the biographer of Thurgood Marshall. And does anyone here want to tell me why that's important this month? Anyone in the hall? Go ahead. Very good. Thank you. He should get a good grade for that. I don't know what whether he's in college or high school, but he deserves a good grade. Thurgood Marshall spent most of his life fighting segregation in the South, risked his life for many years, and eventually he was the lead attorney in the Brown versus Board of Education cases. There were a number of cases, and then he went on in 1967. President Johnson appointed him as the first black justice of the United States Supreme Court. He died in 1993. Juan's book is called Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, and we invite everyone here in the hall and everyone listening on the radio tonight to come and be in the audience on May 27th, that's a Thursday at 7 p.m., and he will talk about Justice Marshall. Tickets for that, free of charge, are available at Thomas Books in downtown Billings. We are here tonight to talk about real life, and there may be some things said that will be potentially offensive to some individuals listening, and we'll warn you up front that if you do not want to listen to a discussion of sexuality and young people and education about sexuality, then you might tune to another station or watch TV or something for the next couple of hours. Let me begin with a quote and then turn to our panelists here in a second, but I want to begin with a quote from our very distinguished former Surgeon General, Dr. David Satcher, who issued a call to action to promote sexual health and responsible behavior. And his call said, to enjoy the important benefits of sexuality, it is necessary for individuals to be sexually healthy, to behave responsibly, and to have a supportive environment to protect their own sexual health as well as that of others. And that's sort of the mission statement that we have for our program tonight. Dr. Satcher's call to action presupposes that we use our highly developed brains. And you know, we're the primates with the big brains, remember? Sometimes it's hard for us to keep that in mind, but we are the primates with the big brains. We have the ability to think about things, to reflect back on things, to plan for the future, and to behave badly as well as correctly. We have morality, and we'll get into that a little bit later on. I'm sure Joe Ripley will want to talk about that. He is presupposing in his mission statement here that we use our highly developed brains to moderate our natural instincts, which do not necessarily contribute to responsible behavior. And to be responsible for our personal behavior, how we relate to other people. The process by which we become human in this sense is education, whether it's in our family our schools, our churches, or in other aspects of our public and private lives. So we're going to talk about what is the role of our schools, or roles, in sexual education. What should be taught? When should it be taught? And what do we expect of our schools? There is a contrast, I think, between what Yellowstone Public Radio and Intermountain Planned Parenthood are assuming would be comprehensive education about sexuality and what actually exists in our schools. So we want to make that contrast tonight as clearly as we can, not to condemn anybody, but to make clear that what we're calling comprehensive sex education doesn't exist in our public schools, and should it? That's a question. We have a distinguished group of people from our community to talk about this, and then later on members of our audience will join in a discussion. Dr. Kyle Colling is Assistant Professor of Rehabilitation and Mental Health Counseling at Montana State University, Billings. Dr. Colling, identify yourself. Okay, good. So that people in the audience will remember who you are. We have a young person who I will not identify by name, who is an HIV-positive young adult from Billings who will be participating in this discussion. If she wishes to identify herself, that's fine, but we will not do that in the program tonight. We have Molly Hale, who is case manager and health educator for the Yellowstone City County Health Department. And Molly is over at the other end of our panel. Drew Colling, same last name, a senior at Senior High School in Billings and a member of the teen board and the board of directors of Intermountain Planned Parenthood, is here, a high school senior. And the Reverend Joe Ripley of Mayflower Congregational Church here in Billings. I think he probably doesn't need to identify himself since he's the only male on the stage. What do we mean? What do you mean when we talk about sex education in the schools in terms of what we need? Dr. Colling?
I believe that sex education in schools should begin at a very early age, and that it should continue throughout a child's school experience, that it should be developmentally appropriate to the age level of the child, that it should include a great deal of information about how our bodies work and about sexuality in general, and information about how we protect ourselves and keep ourselves safe, and how we prevent pregnancy. I believe that it should be balanced and unbiased and thorough. And I think that we can look at data from other developed countries in the world and see that comprehensive sex education does in fact work to help young people keep themselves healthy and well.
There are a number of questions that are automatically suggested by your opening statement, and we'll get to those questions later on, such as which countries and how long have they been doing this and how is their culture different from ours. Our next panelist, I want to ask you the same question. What is your vision of what ought to be taught in our public schools to create or promote sexually healthy people?
I think that we should have a comprehensive sex education, of course, age-appropriate, like she said. I think that it should also be taught from an early age, and that contraception should be taught, like healthy and not healthy relationships, you know, because I think it's not just about sex, that it should also be about the relationships between people. I think that's an important aspect with it also.
Thank you. Reverend Ripley?
Yeah, I think what's been said has been excellent. There needs to be openness, dialogue, opportunities for dialogue, not just one-way teaching, but dialogue. Age appropriateness is one that would be another one to come back and maybe touch on, because I think when you look into that, information about what is age appropriate for most parents tends to be more explicit younger. than most parents are comfortable with, which is something that perhaps we can again come back and address later on.
Certainly will, yes. True?
You know, I think that they need to have more and longer. They start in, like, you know, the fifth grade, and they'll have it for a week. They need to reiterate this stuff throughout their education and just kind of teach them more about what they're going to be facing in real life. You know, make it so that they understand this is a real thing and it's not just make-believe.
Okay, Molly Hale.
I would have to agree with the rest of the panelists. I think promoting good decision-making, and good decision-making comes from having all the facts. And so being open and honest to be able to talk about all the different choices that kids are facing is really important to comprehensive education.
I'd like to go back to Dr. Colling. First of all, to ask where in the world do they teach comprehensive education about sexuality? How early do they do it, and what do they teach? Let's go back and reintroduce that.
Sure. It's taught in almost all the developed nations in the world. And, for example, if I can compare and contrast just pregnancy rates, basic pregnancy rates, the United States is higher in pregnancy and in childbirth and in STIs, which is sexually transmitted infections, than any of the other developed nations in the world. And, in fact, the closest one to us, I believe, is Great Britain. And so, for example, if we're looking just at pregnancy data, we would have 83.6 people per young women per thousand, and Great Britain would have 46.7, almost half of our rate. And then it goes down from there.
We also, in a previous forum in this room, discussed the murder rate in this country compared with other countries. What is it about our culture, as opposed to those other countries, that we have such... We have 11,000 murders a year in this country, and I think the closest European country had 300. What is it about our country that is so different?
You know, I can't answer that from any reading that I've done, but let me address the issue of sexuality, and this is just my own personal opinion on this. We treat sexuality in a titillating fashion. It's in other countries, sexuality is recognized and almost revered as a natural part of humanity and a normal part of development and growing up, and not something to be whispered about or not spoken about, but something that receives respect in the culture. And I think it's not treated with respect in our culture. I think it's the media treats it in ways that are not respectful.
Why is that the case, Reverend Ripley, when I think a higher percentage of Americans regard themselves as believing in God and being religious than any European country?
Now, I was going to say that there's probably a connection there, and it would seem to be almost the opposite of one might think. That I do believe that America has more... open in practice of religion, and so one would think it would be the opposite. I think a point on that is that there is some understanding, although it's never or rarely directly spoken, in religious thought that says sexuality and sexual acts are somehow connected to or the source of sin. In other words, sexual expression and sexuality is inherently wrong.
Isn't that clearly in the Bible?
And banned. No, it is not. In fact, what Scripture says is that human beings were created male and female in God's image, and it was good. So we're created sexual beings. God made us that way. It's a gift from God. But the problem with the assumption about sex being inherently bad or sinful is that leads to a belief that we need to restrict sexual activity. In other words, it can only be appropriate then in certain kinds of very rigid and limited settings. For instance, procreation, making babies. If that's you know, the result or the desire of the sexual activity, well, it's not good, but you can kind of forgive it. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's inherently bad or taboo. And I think that undercurrent plays through, and it's one of the ways that our religious heritage, again, I think if you examine that thought, it's not consistent with Scripture, but it is one that is pervasive in our culture, and I think leads to the kinds of things, the statistics that were being talked about.
How do we go to the idea that sexuality is for pleasure and still not fall into the trap of titillation that Dr. Colling referred to? If sex isn't just for procreation, if it is for human pleasure, then anybody can respond to this. How do we keep it from being what Dr. Colling describes it as being, a kind of shallow public education? Dr. Colling, you can comment on that if you'd like.
I feel like in our culture there is so much emphasis put on outward appearance and physical appearance, and sexuality as it relates to that outward appearance, that there's no sense of depth. And what Drew brought up, I think, is really profound, because a healthy and natural expression of sexuality includes a respectful relationship with the other person, and all the good things that come from a mature, engaged, fully engaged, intimate sexual relationship. And, you know, I don't know how we turn things around from where we are. I really don't. But I'll tell you, if you haven't picked up a teen magazine on the newsstands, I would strongly recommend that you do that, because it's all about sex and sexuality and skin, really. Young girls' skin.
I'm going to quote something really crude here, because I heard it 1,000 times at least when I was in high school in the 1950s. Slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. I don't know where young men learn that attitude. I know a lot of them learn it from their fathers, who are trying to pass on to them what it means to be a man. I'm sure they also learn it from their peers. I'm just going to dump that problem on all five of you. How do you deal with that?
I think we need to identify role models that are good for our teens to be looking up to. I think a lot of times, you know, the people that are portraying that sort of image are cool. You know, and we see that in the movies or TV shows. And so I think in order for our society to start looking at that differently, we need to identify different role models.
How do we create a different role model, though, in our public schools when they are surrounded by these magazines, these television programs, these video games, and on and on and on, that purvey a different role? I mean, how do you fight that? We live in a very commercial culture, and I'm being skeptical here. I'm not cynical necessarily, but skeptical. How can you fight that battle successfully in public education?
Well, I might suggest that that's part of what's wrong with the let's not talk about it. You know, the concept that we can do that is ludicrous. Of course, it's actually ludicrous in the history of humanity. Again, since God created us sexual beings, we cannot choose to be non-sexual. You know, we can choose whether or not we want to have piercings or tattoos or, you know, what color our hair is going to be and how long, but we cannot choose to be not sexual. So trying to pretend like we can just not talk about it, you know, that's lost from the start. So, you know, I think recognizing that we do need to address then issues of how are we going to use this God-given gift? How are we going to, you know, how is that going to play out in our life? Certainly attempting to not talk about it is not only wrong-minded, but it's, you know, that's the opposite of what we need to do. We need to be open about it. How else are we going to say and be able to show, you know, situations and relationships where, sexuality is expressed appropriately versus those things like Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire and all of the other sexual pandering that is out there. I mean,
I want to ask the two young women who've not talked about this what you encounter in school in terms of the attitudes I just expressed in that phrase. You must hear this and you must experience. How do young women react to this reality that they experience in school and other places?
I guess from at least my perspective, it's a lot of pressure because you're expected to almost be like this sort of sexual being that these guys are seeing in magazines or on TV or whatever. And, you know, just, you know, a lot of girls, it's just no, you know, it's not what they're about. It's something, it's more than skin deep. You know, and I think that being able to talk about sex would be a great help, because then, you know, you have the information you need to make positive choices for yourself, and therefore I think you can be in a more positive relationship if you're informed about choices and if you're able to respect your health and your body. So
that's good. Drew, how do you deal with what you hear in the halls?
I'm Drew.
I'm sorry. I don't know how I did that. Here. Okay.
My name is Paige.
Paige, how do you deal with what you encounter on the street, in the halls at school from young males?
I think that there is for a girl to be accepted, to feel wanted and loved, cared about, they have twisted it all around and turned it into something sexual rather than really showing a personality. I think that's one of the things that they need to educate people on, is building your self-esteem to know that you are worth more than that. They need to, you know, express on what is a real positive relationship. A lot of kids have never seen a good positive relationship. We're coming from broken homes and dysfunctional families, so that isn't something that we know. I think if we can learn that and teach that and find some way, even bring the parents into this education, I think would up that a lot. I see young girls that are 14, you know, with guys grabbing all over them, and they don't know. They don't understand that is not love. That is not what they want to go through in life. I just think that we need to learn how to build each other's and our own self-esteem to know that we can achieve more than this.
And if you're really young without much sense of who you are, you can interpret that as a compliment. You can interpret that as meaning you're desirable.
Yes.
The fact that that's difficult. Sorry, I got your names confused. Going back to the role model question, should there be a parental advisory function for public schools that would help work out what kind of role model we, meaning parents as well as teachers and administrators and other people, health professionals, how do we arrive at the term comprehensive sounds to me like it's not an easy road to get to that goal. What kind of involvement should parents have to get there? And what kind of controversy can you expect about that?
I think that a lot of parents don't know how to address certain situations and certain things, or else they're scared. They feel like if they're telling their children about this stuff, that means that they're promoting it. They are not promoting it. If you are talking about it, you're giving them information to make the choice on their own. They're going to do it regardless. They might as well have the information to make the right choice and to protect themselves. So I think that adults need to have the information on how to do this, rather than, you know.
How do we avoid the situation where the school board says we're going to have comprehensive sexual education, and then these people come in a long line to their meetings and tell them why they have no business being involved in it? How do we avoid that kind of situation?
You know, that kind of situation could certainly arise, Marvin, and I think this forum is really a wonderful opportunity to open this dialogue in our own community. But if we look at the national data, about 9 out of 10 people surveyed nationally want comprehensive sex education in the public schools. People want it. I don't understand why, when 9 out of 10 people in the United States say we want comprehensive sex education in the public schools, and like something like 127 very august bodies, including the Surgeon General's Office, the American Medical Association, mm-hmm. CDC, on and on, say that indeed we absolutely must have comprehensive sex education. Why a small number of politicians in Washington determine that we cannot?
Well, I don't think it's a small number of politicians in Washington. I think it's, I doubt if there's anybody from the school board in this room. I doubt if they would even show up at a forum like this.
I'm on the school board.
Yeah, okay. All right.
I'm on a committee for the school board.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Marvin,
it isn't just those people. It's us.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a fair question. Why not leave sexuality as a subject to be talked about at home? You know, why not leave it there? And I think that's a fair question to consider, because that's really what you come up with if you say whose parents are going to have input into the process and what's discussed. And the reality is, there are some parents and children, you know, young folks, that do a great job of talking about those issues. Now, I think it's a whole lot fewer than most people would imagine. The problem with it is the parents aren't comfortable talking about those issues with their children as they enter adolescence, and children in that age are not comfortable talking about their parents. And so what you have is a situation where a few can do it. The vast majority cannot do it, or not do it well or completely, and that ignorance is killing, literally killing our young people. And that is unfathomable to me, that we would allow ignorance in our educational system to have such a devastating effect.
How can a teacher in a public school, how can a pastor in a church become a facilitator to overcome that wall?
Well, you know, that is also a challenging issue, and I think a piece of it needs to be, if you, the more you are aware of the information and the facts about alternatives and how things are done other places, programs that have been successful, I think it helps to motivate you to say, well, we can do this too. There's an implicit assumption for many people, and I think perhaps it's for most parents because it's wishful thinking, and that is, if we don't talk about sexuality, young folks won't have sex. Never been true in the history of the world. Never. You know.
Is it because we believe in creation? Because I talk with my children about our evolution as a species and the fact that we come out of a fairly sorry history, like every other animal does, and that somewhere along the line we developed the capability to actually make decisions about these things and not have it be just... I mean, sex is exploitation to a large part in nature, or as one evolutionary psychologist put it, men pursue, women select in nature. Women select the male that they perceive as being the best father of their children, but it is the male that does the pursuing in most cases, and that's done fairly crudely in nature from the viewpoint of human civilization. Can we not talk about this in public schools because it's evolution? I mean, what is the problem of talking about how we have developed as a species to be at where we are? Because aren't we really dealing with keeping our instincts under control and moderated to the point where we can treat each other with respect and deal with each other with respect, rather than just being the beast that is still in us? I mean, am I way off track here?
Well, I would choose to talk about that and think about that differently. Again, realizing I'm coming from a religious perspective, you know, again, sexuality is a good and gracious gift from a good and loving God. It's
What if you don't believe in God?
Well, for those folks, there's another way to think about that. I'm talking, sharing from my perspective. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that maybe we shouldn't talk about that because it's somehow bestial, again, I think that goes back to that. I think there's, for many folks, this religious assumption that sexuality is associated with beastly behavior, sinful behavior.
No, I'm not talking about sin. Sin doesn't mean anything to me in the context of this question. Beastly behavior means that you take what you want. That's all I'm talking about. In nature, that is a very common phenomenon. You don't check and see whether someone feels, whether the female animal feels receptive or not. I mean, that's not on the male mind in nature. And I'm just wondering if we don't still have problems keeping our emotions, our desires, those aggressive desires that are usually associated with males, under control. I mean, you say it's sex has been there forever. Well, I think those aggressive feelings have been there for forever. And how do we make them behave so that we can have a civilization? I mean, I'm posing that as a question, although you obviously can tell I have some convictions there.
Yeah. We hear that.
No, but I mean, that's a question I'd like you to answer or respond to.
I think talking about it is just absolutely essential, because when we talk about it together, then each one of us learns that the other person has feelings and thoughts, and we develop the skills to communicate with each other on a much more personal level. And that's the thing that I think takes away that superficiality and makes things good and like they should be. And not talking about it, we never have the opportunity to do that.
We should go back, I think, to the reference to the national poll. If people go, and I'm sure they can go other places, but to npr.org, and in the search box, just write in sex education, there is a long, long report from the Kaiser Family Foundation, Harvard University, and National Public Radio, which conducted a national poll on whether people thought comprehensive sex education should be taught in public schools. And you're absolutely right. Overwhelmingly, they said yes.
Yes,
indeed. So why is it a problem?
You know, it's a problem because federal funding is tied to abstinence only until marriage education. And in fact, that's in the new Nickleby legislation as well.
Isn't that because the president, and going back to a few people in the Congress, have a rather strange view of human sexuality?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I have my own personal political beliefs that I'll try to stay away from here, but federal funding should not be tied to abstinence only until marriage education, because every bit of science that we have does not support that. And clearly, it's not effective. Clearly, it's not. All we have to do is look at the statistics, the incidence rates, and the epidemiological studies to know that what we're doing is not working. And we're putting our children at huge unnecessary risk, not just for pregnancy, increased risk of cancer, for increased risk of lifelong infertility, for HIV and AIDS. You know, we put our young children at absolutely unnecessary risk.
We had a forum in January on kids and drugs, and on this stage, one of the major participants sort of made the case that kids shouldn't learn about drugs, you know, because they shouldn't be taught about. The professor who was here from the University of California had worked with teenagers for years and said, and had a young woman, in fact, on a video saying, to know the difference between marijuana and crack is very, very important. And yet another voice on the stage was saying that teaching anything about that will contribute to the behavior. Isn't that really what we're talking about with sexuality? And is there any truth to that? Does anybody up here think that learning about sexuality would lead anyone to engage in it
There's absolutely no data to support that. Absolutely no data to support that teaching sexual education increases sexual behavior. In fact, it has the opposite effect. It can serve to delay sexual behavior, and it can also support the appropriate use of contraception and protection to protect young people against disease. And that's exactly the effect that we want to have. And there's no data to support that it has a deleterious effect.
Can we go across and get other responses to that? Anyone else have a...
Well, I think that our main goal, especially, you know, from the health department, is we just want to educate people. You know, knowledge gives people power to make good choices for themselves. You know, we don't want to go into the schools and, you know, pass out condoms and that sort of thing. We just want to go in there and give the kids the right information so that they can make the right choices for themselves.
Is there evidence of a reduction of HIV infection and other sexually transmitted infections where people do hand out condoms and where they do? I mean, that could be part of a comprehensive sex education program. Have there been studies of that? Does it reduce the incidence of illness and of pregnancy?
I was reviewing that data recently, and I couldn't find any hard data that supports that having condoms available, you know, like in the schools, and there are a few programs that are like that. It did increase condom use, and I don't think the studies have gone on long enough to really have a good sense of that. You know, so that's all I know.
Reducing unwanted pregnancies and thereby reducing abortions is one of the goals that I find that Intermountain Planned Parenthood and the National Planned Parenthood Organization has as a goal. They tend to be associated with providing services to people, but they really, at least in what I've read here, would like to prevent abortions by keeping the number of unwanted pregnancies under control. And I still don't have a sense of how early do we want to start that process? Do we do it by teaching science? When we say we want to teach them the facts of life, do they learn that in elementary school science classes? Is that a beginning?
I think in my experience, we began to learn like about our bodies early on, like early in elementary school, about fourth or third grade. You know, and I think that's very important because we need to understand how our bodies work. Then, like, years later, then we finally got to learn a little tiny bit about condom use and how it reduces the risk for STI, sexually transmitted infections. But that's the only information that I remember being given.
Paige, do you have a response to that, or about how early and what kind of education would be valuable? I mean, you can't teach little tiny elementary kids to make decisions, but you can start the process of having them learn about their bodies, as Drew suggested.
I don't know. Personally, I think that, you know, around third or fourth grade is a good time to start teaching them about their bodies, their anatomies, stuff like that. As far as into the sexual part of it, I think around, you know, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, I think, is the most influential time. I think that is when this stuff really needs to be pushed. Those are the hardest years of your life, because you're not a child anymore, but you're not a teenager, but you're going through puberty. They have all these raging hormones, everything, and they don't know exactly what is really going on here. Mm-hmm. I think that they need to be informed about the sexually transmitted infections. I think they need to be informed about HIV. I think they need to be informed about pregnancy and everything that goes along with it. I think that, you know, bringing people in who have been through it, who can talk to them from a personal perspective to say, hey, you know, look, this is real. I think that things like that are very important. You know, I wish when I was in school that somebody could have told me, look, you know, if you're taking these risks, you need to have this information to be able to make a good, positive decision. So one day you're not sitting there, you know, thinking, well, you know, I wish I would have known that. Yeah, because that could save your life. I mean, parents, and I think one thing that they don't think about when they're thinking the abstinence only is, yeah, there are parents who will throw a fit because they don't want their children exposed to that. They think that that's going to promote this. Well, what about those parents that really haven't said anything but who are completely for it? You know, they're, what about all those people who are like, okay, you know, maybe that is something that we should look into. But they just don't come out and say anything. I think that anybody who has any, you know, really feels strongly about something needs to go out and express those feelings. And, you know,
even if it might make them unpopular in the community?
You know, I could really care less about being popular personally. But, you know, it's just something that I think it needs to be done. I don't think there's any ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Reverend Ripley.
Mara, let me say, I want to take a little exception with what was said. How young is too young? You know, when do children talk? Okay. I think that needs to be an integral part. Kindergartners need to understand you are the boss of your body.
Right.
And if someone says stop, you have to stop. Because if it's their body, you know, how young is it too young to teach that?
Well,
I mean, whether you're pulling on their arm on the playground or whatever you're doing. That's a part of the education process that needs to happen and can happen and should happen from from the earliest days of school.
I assume that euphemisms are still learned for sexual organs and bodily functions with little children, that we don't somehow, we're not comfortable using real language with them. I mean, I don't know why that is, but again, maybe it goes back to our reluctance to talk about sex. But I don't know how many little boys or little girls are taught about penises and vaginas right from the very beginning. There usually is some cutesy poo name or something.
Well, and if parents don't do it, other children will help them, you know, supply those names.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I remember when I was little, I think if you weren't learning it from your parents or you weren't learning it from school, you were learning it from your friends on the bus.
Yeah, I remember just lots and lots of manly talk on the bus.
You know,
I
think it's really important to point out that for girls, young girls, who are initiated into sex at a very young age, a high percentage of those report having been coerced or forced. And so I am so in favor of starting very early and, like you said, teaching refusal skills to understand that this is not something you have to do. And not only refusal skills, but how to get help if you need it. You know, so that if something is happening, what can you as a very young child do about it? Empowering children over their own bodies.
I don't want to pick on the Reverend, and I know he comes from a liberal progressive religious tradition in this country, but aren't there still religious institutions teaching young girls that they should be subordinate to males? They should be subordinate to their husbands when they marry, and their mothers should be subordinate to their fathers while they're growing up. Isn't that still part of the act that some institutions engage in?
Well, I wish I could say that that was not true, but I think there are some folks who, in my view, mistakenly understand scripture and their faith to come to that conclusion, and that I do think that that does play a part in assuming a different role or different understanding for young women than young men. And that's tragic.
Are those the people who are going to show up at the school board hearing?
I would suspect a great many of that. Folks who are informed by that often believe that, you know, very seriously, because it's a part of their fundamental faith understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they're often going to express views about concerns of that. And I think, you know, you'd ask a question about parental input. I think there needs to be some ways of allowing parental input that's appropriate, and yet at the same time having parents be able to say specifically, I do not want my children exposed to that. Now, I think that's tragic for parents that would do that. I think it's depriving them of information that they need. Yet, I think that in a public school situation, that needs to be allowed, where parents just can say, you know, I don't want my young man or young woman learning about that. Even though I believe that puts them at increased risk, lots of parents do that in other ways with their young folks, mm-hmm. put them at increased risk.
People differ on the relationship between learning facts and making moral or ethical judgments. I have to confess again that I'm one of those who tends to believe that the more people know, the better moral judgments they can make. But some people would say that teaching the morality of sexuality is not a function of the schools, or to teach morality about anything else. But isn't that important in our society? I mean, all morality doesn't have to be based on institutional or traditional religion. I mean, they're just how we respect and relate to each other are moral issues, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's another factor that is a layered thing, and it's more complicated. I believe educational institutions have a role in education. That's not all education. There are components that we deliberately decide are not included as part of that, and things like teaching and sharing faith is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that education in public schools should be the only education. Institutionalized religion and faith taught at home, those are very important ways of engaging and informing people. The idea that if we don't talk about sexuality, then it won't happen is the opposite of the reality. The reality is, when it's openly talked about, often people engage in less risky behavior, and they engage in it later in life. And where that comes from is an open talk of the morality and the other, you know, the emotional, as well as what we've been talking about, physical risks, which are very real and very important. But that's not the only risk.
Mm-hmm.
Those places, you know, that's where that needs to happen, is that probably can't happen, or at least not fully happen, in public education settings. But we do have these other institutions, and that's a great place for those discussions to supplement mm-hmm. the information, the facts about human sexuality.
Can there be open discussions between religious leaders and public educators about these issues without somebody complaining? I mean, why should not they be able to talk about some of the issues that we're raising here as people who have a common interest and not necessarily as one trying to influence or control the other? I mean, is there any place we know of where that goes on, where ministers and rabbis are involved with?
Yeah, often there are settings where, for instance, in sexuality education, that there is input to school boards from folks like clergy mm-hmm. as well as from parents, and that's a component of that. I think the problem is when you wind up with people with very diverse views about the role of women, about the inherent evil, perhaps, of sexuality, then that can really, then it makes it difficult to find common ground to serve the main purpose, which is around education and providing information. So I think you've hit on something that's very difficult, but it's not impossible.
I want to say that we'll open up the possibility for questions and comments, by the way, to people who are in the audience here in just a few moments. I was going to introduce another whole can of worms, but I think I'll let people participate in what has been said so far, and then does anyone have a comment or a question that they want to? I'm going to pass the microphone to you, and you can carry forth.
I have a question for Molly, and then anybody else that you know, wants to jump in. We've been talking about statistics and national statistics, and I think sometimes people think, oh, that can't be in Billings, Montana, or that can't be in Yellowstone County. And so I was wondering if you could share what the statistics are in Yellowstone County for things like sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, any kind of information like that. Thank you.
In Montana, we've had 616 people diagnosed with HIV and AIDS. And that's probably one third of the people that we know of that have HIV or AIDS. So we definitely are seeing that here in Montana. In the last 2 years in Yellowstone County, we had 5 young women diagnosed with HIV, which was rather alarming to us because we hadn't seen that trend at all. And that's kind of where the national statistics were going, but we weren't seeing that in Montana. And so now that we're seeing that in Montana, you know, it just emphasizes the importance of getting the education out to young adults because, you know, many of these young women, when we've talked to them, you know, and including Paige, you know, would probably say, I wasn't at risk. I would never have known that, you know, I was at risk for HIV. I think our statistics for STDs are rising.
We say what sexually transmitted diseases?
Yes.
Everybody listening knows what those...
Sexually transmitted diseases can include... The two most common ones that we look at are chlamydia and gonorrhea, and those can be treated with antibiotics and cleared up, but if someone doesn't go in to get tested, then it could eventually lead to sterility. And so it's really important for people that are having sex or unprotected sex with other people for them to come in and get tested for HIV, gonorrhea, chlamydia. You know, those are probably the most common ones. But I wrote down some statistics for Yellowstone County for last year in 2003. And between the ages of 10 and 14, we had 4 females that were diagnosed with chlamydia in Yellowstone County. And then between the ages of 15 to 19, we had 14 males and 144 females diagnosed with chlamydia. So you can just look at those statistics and just see, you know, what's happening in our young people and why it's so important to get the right information out to them. At least if they're at risk, they need to get tested so they can find out.
Do any of you want to comment on how something that was originally identified with homosexual males is now such a heterosexual phenomenon in our society? Does anyone know the history of how that changed?
I can probably comment on that. A lot of homosexuals, you know, might not identify as being homosexuals, and they might be married or bisexual. And so then the woman is the receptive partner, and so that puts her at the most risk. And so then that brings that home, you know, to her or to her partner. And so that's why we're starting to see this increase in women becoming infected, you know, here in Montana and nationally.
Is a woman's body more nurturing of these germs or whatever, viruses or whatever they are correctly identified as than the male body is?
Yes, definitely. The receptive partner, the female or the male, is the most at risk,
okay,
especially for HIV.
Anyone else want to comment on that phenomenon? I want to say to Paige how impressed I am with how articulate you are on this. You sound almost professorial, which is that's a compliment, by the way. Does anybody else here want to add their comments or their questions to our discussion? You are welcome to comment as well as question if you'd like. Again, okay.
I'd like to know Paige's experience and how she thinks that maybe having had a better education may have been helpful to her.
I think that a little bit of education could have done wonders. I think that a lot that would have made me think about things a little bit more is knowing that it is real, is knowing that, you know, it's not just the people on TV. It's not just something that they make up so that you're not going to go out there and experiment. It's very real. It is in Billings, Montana. I was born and raised here, went through school district too. I did not get the education I needed. I didn't, when I was diagnosed with HIV, I didn't even really know what I had. I had no idea where to go for care. I didn't even know to go get tested. The only reason I found out I had HIV was because I decided to go into the Navy, and that's part of what they do is my processing. So I had no idea what I was really getting myself into. And I think that that could have done a world of difference. And I know a lot of people that just from knowing me, that knowing that it is real, they've taken a second thought and looked at that just a little bit differently on, okay, well, is this a gamble worth taking? And I think that's something that's very important.
I'm sure there are radio listeners asking themselves, how are you treated for this? What kind of future do you have as somebody who is HIV plus?
You know, I have actually had a very, you know, my experience being HIV positive hasn't been all negative. It's interesting hearing a lot of people's ignorance in regards to it. It's not looked at as a disease. It's looked at as, oh, God, you're nasty, you know. Yeah.
God's judgment, maybe, even, you know.
It's people judge as to, you know, what they think it is. They look at it. They don't look at it like, say, cancer. Mm-hmm. When someone gets cancer, they didn't ask for that. Just like I didn't ask for this disease. Fortunately, I'm one of those people. I am very open with my status, because if I can make a difference in one other person, to have that knowledge to go out there, I'm doing more than I ever could have before. And that is something that, you know, there's days that I think, you know, it's actually worth it. So.
During the last part of this program, I'd like to open that can of worms that I mentioned earlier and maybe go back to Dr. Colling's opening remarks a little bit about other countries in relation to ours. We've been called a melting pot, and other people have said we're more like a fruit salad or a fruitcake. We have many, many nationalities, ethnicities, racial heritages in our society, and it's becoming even more so as time goes on. Not being a homogeneous society in terms of cultural background, religious history, doesn't that make all of this really difficult for us because of our, I mean, we talk about our diversity being a plus, but in this regard, in the context of trying to develop something like comprehensive sex education in the schools, isn't our diversity of tradition more of an obstacle than a plus? Does anyone have the courage to address that? Nobody wants to say that our diversity isn't good, but I mean, some cases it makes it difficult for us, does it not? If we were all Congregationalists, Pat Buchanan even said once, if we were all Catholics, it would be a much more peaceful society. And I don't think he was saying that.
Although I happen to think he was wrong in that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think that the same would be true if we were all Congregationalists, which of course we could not be, but even if we were, there's people that have many different views on issues of human sexuality as well as all other issues. So, I mean, that is not a monolithic group.
So is that because of their ethnic backgrounds or their racial histories or what that might also contribute to that? Do the Irish have a different attitude toward sexuality than the Poles? I'm just curious about, anybody studied that sort of thing? You mentioned what countries again have comprehensive sex education?
Great Britain, Canada, Netherlands, France, the developed countries.
Now, 80% of the French people identify themselves as Catholic, and yet 13% of them, I believe it is, ever go to Mass. Does that is it because these nations are more secular than we are? I mean, that goes back to the beginning of our discussion in a way.
I think not. I think our diversity can be a real advantage in this. The danger is not the diversity. The danger is extremist opinions carrying the day. When there is not a diversity of expression around issues like this, when if it boils down to the most restrictive opinion on any issue is going to be the one that we will carry it with, that's a real handicap and makes things very difficult. But it's not about diversity. It's about extreme opinions. I think the... well, you know, I got a mailing here this past week, which was just fascinating. And if I can read just one sentence out of this, this is religious based. What it says is, scientific evidence indicates more rapes, abortions, and sexually transmitted diseases will result if the FDA approves the over-the-counter sale of the morning after pill, which was just turned down in news I saw today. I'm appalled. As a scientist, you know, this is where people are going to get information. If we don't give them real information, they're going to assume this kind of hooey has some basis in fact. There's no scientific evidence that could ever show such a thing. And this is what's passing for information. This is what our folks are exposed to. And if they don't have real information, they have no ability to counter this other than by thinking perhaps, you know, it's a crock. Which it certainly is.
To go back to that other kind of religious tradition, it has to be in the minds of some lawmakers and some citizens that if people aren't punished for sin, then there's just more sin. I mean, isn't that the way they look at it? Just to offer up phooey evidence like that for like a morning after pill, I mean, that will tend to take people off the hook.
Well, again, I think
sinners.
I think the problem with this is not about punishing sin, which, of course, I would have some fundamentally different ways of talking about and expressing. But this isn't about punishing sin. This is attempting to suggest that having something available to protect people's health and to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies and abortions, that somehow that is going to cause more people to be raped.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fundamental problem here.
Sure.
Okay, it's not that it's about punishment. It's
people
about misinformation. And this kind of information is out there all over the place.
But aren't people bothered by the attempt of science, I'm going to put it in their terms now, the attempt of science to remove the consequences of your behavior? I mean, they believe people should have to live with the consequences of their behavior, don't they? And if the morning after pill contributes to your health after you have committed sin, in their view, I mean, I really think that a lot of people have a contradiction about.
Well, I do think there are folks who don't well think through their ideas of that. Certainly, it is not even if you have some, you know, what I would call demonic desire to punish a person for their behavior. It is certainly not the fault of a child or a future child. Certainly they should not be punished, you know, for something that they had no ability to participate
in. But you know, in their mind, this is not demonic punishment. This is the wrath of God we're talking about here.
I'm so sorry for those who
yes.
have that kind of misunderstanding.
Dr. Colling, did you want to comment? I just want to put you on the spot.
I guess I tend to stay out of the religious side of things.
Okay.
I absolutely do agree that there is so much misinformation, and it's so important for people to have accurate, unbiased, balanced information about what their options are. Then people can really act upon that and make good choices. And I want to speak from my own personal perspective as a parent of a wonderful daughter. Drew and I are really close, and we talk about a lot of different things, but I have to say that I'm a little shy when it comes to sexuality, and I don't know that I've done all that great a job of talking with her about it, because I feel a little uncomfortable with it, probably because of my age and stage and the place and time I grew up and all that kind of thing. But I have made feeble attempts, and we've been blessed in that Drew has been actively engaged in Planned Parenthood, I think, since you began high school, hasn't it? Isn't it, honey?
I was a sophomore.
Sophomore in high school. And she has received what 95% of our children do not receive, and that is a comprehensive sex education. And she would come home from her meetings with additional questions or with bits of information, and I could then talk with her about it. It was a door that opened where we could sit down and have a discussion. It was such a tremendous relief to me to know that she was really being well educated, and that I could support that with my own personal values and beliefs, and she could share her own personal values and beliefs, which are different than mine, but I can totally respect where she's coming from. I've seen maturity from her. I've seen wonderful choices. And I really feel so strongly that every child should have that benefit, should have that education. It should be available to every child in the public schools. And I do want to say, too, when you were talking about diversity, I don't know that the dividing line is so much different racial or ethnic groups, but where the line divides is people who are living in poverty, mm-hmm. or people from lower socioeconomic status. Those people are disproportionately affected by STIs, by pregnancy, at a young age, you know, in ways that reduce the quality of their lives when it should never happen that way. And our public school system is in some ways a great equalizer of that, and they're perfectly positioned to deliver this kind of an education, and there are marvelous curricula, national curricula, that have already been developed. It's not like we have to start from ground zero, but we have materials that are really well developed that we can look at as a community and really use. So I just wanted to be sure that I shared my own personal experience mm-hmm. related to that.
It's very good, and I think it's probably perhaps good to add that.
And I think that one of the points on that which really needs to be underscored is programs that are age appropriate and graduated, like Our Whole Lives is one that was mm-hmm. developed
yes.
in conjunction with a whole lot of input from a whole lot of people.
Yes.
We don't have to start from a blank piece of paper
no.
and say, okay, what should we tell kindergartners? What
no.
should we tell sixth graders?
No.
You know, what should we tell people in high school?
What is Our Whole Lives?
It is a comprehensive sexuality education program that was developed again by a cross section of folks. And
can people get access to this on the internet? If they want to know more about it?
Yeah, I feel sure. If I'm probably one of the ways to do that would be actually through a church tie, because I know that one. UCC.org connects you to the United Church of Christ main access, and through there, Our Whole Lives, that sexuality curriculum.
And they developed this in collaboration with other groups, or was it
that's a multi-denominational
yeah, okay.
thing, also with input from a whole lot of different fields.
Sure, that's interesting.
So,
yeah.
So that, I guess the point that was being made, which I wholeheartedly concur with, is we don't have to start from square one.
Mm-hmm.
There's really good, well thought out programs that are laid out there that can be used as a basis of saying, how does this fit for us here in Billings, Montana?
One of the things that follows from what Dr. Colling was saying is that people who are in poverty and who lack basic education are not stupid. I mean, you know that, all of you know that. But they are stressed very often. Their lives are sufficiently stressed that they can't think about things that are not survival kinds of things. And that we forget sometimes. Public radio listeners tend to be middle-class people. And we forget that that other people sometimes have so much stress and worry in their lives about their incomes and about their children and about their relationship, their marriages and so forth, that they just don't have the wherewithal to devote themselves to to questions like we're talking about tonight. And that's just true, you know.
You know, I think it's also important to recognize that young people whose lives have been mostly lived in poverty, oftentimes, for example, young mothers who have babies, those babies will grow up and have babies at a very young age. And part of what we know is that we can make a difference with young women when they know that there are alternatives to that. And education is absolutely essential. Education and models are absolutely essential to that, because we know that for young women who have mothers who are educated, those young women are at less risk of an early pregnancy. So
what about a senior? Are there any clubs or informal organizations of people who are interested in this and want to pursue it? Or is that something too weird?
No, it's actually, with administration, it's a very taboo subject. The only group that I know of is a PSI, and that's postponing sexual involvement, which is taught at middle schools, which is, of course, an abstinence-based,
yeah,
but abstinence-only education. And other than that, it's a very taboo subject.
Could we have an appraisal from each of you of the abstinence-only approach? And we might add to this, I mean, that also was brought up in our Kids and Drugs program, was that the case against comprehensive education is that just say no. If you just stay away from it until you are of an age where you can be responsible, then that's all you need to know. Would you all five give your, I don't want to, again, get you into politics, but you must have an opinion of abstinence only as an approach to this question?
Actually, I was looking at a study that looked at the Just Say No approach, and it surveyed teens nationally, view of the effectiveness of the Just Say No programs, and teens feel it is absolutely not helpful. So, I mean, that, what better information could we have than from the source saying, no, it's not helpful to me at all?
True. I would say that our current abstinence-only education breeds ignorance, and in that it's putting teens and youth in grave danger. You know, they don't know their options. You know, they're ill-prepared for the consequences of sex, and you know, so I think what abstinence-only based education does is promote ignorance.
Joe?
Yeah, and you know what they say about the truth, right? The truth will set you free, and truth requires information. Because we are created sexual beings, trying to pretend that we're not, or trying to pretend that you can just not be sexual, it's, you know, it's not only against, I think, human nature, which I think was one of your points earlier. I think it goes against God's gift to us. And so trying to pretend as if you can just not talk about it, or just say don't do it, it's never worked in the history of civilization. So I'm flabbergasted that in a relatively educated and sophisticated society, anybody would think that would work.
Paige?
I think that abstinence only is a waste of time. I think, you know, promoting abstinence is wonderful. You know, promoting that you wait till you're married. But if you decide, if you choose to make other decisions, if you have other plans, then at least have that information available and out there to them. Yes, promote abstinence, but not only abstinence. Also, you know, promote safe sex, promote other things, so that when they do make that choice, because teenagers have a mind of their own. You know, I know I didn't listen to my parents. I didn't listen to my teachers. You know, they don't know what they're talking about. But it's just, you know, they need to have the information in order to make a good decision. So, you know, abstinence is great, but add a little bit of something else in there too.
Molly?
I think abstinence only is very limiting, and it almost keeps everything else a secret from the kids. I think that they need to have as much information to make good choices. You know, as I've said before, I think that a lot of times teens are going to make up their own minds. And, you know, as Paige said, they're not going to listen to the adults because they're going to learn it their way, and it's probably going to be the hard way. So I think being able to give them all the information so they can make a good choice, you know, is what I would prefer.
We have just a few minutes left. Does anyone on the stage want to raise an issue or a question or make a little speech maybe about a point of view or another subject related to this? You're certainly welcome to do it.
You know, I think it's important that we understand, when we think about abstinence-only education, that we understand that by age 18, about 71% of our young people have had sexual intercourse, and that most of the studies I looked at suggested that at least a third more than that have experimented sexually in ways that put them at risk. They might consider themselves to be virgins, quote unquote, but they've experimented sexually in ways that put themselves at significant risk. So it is a huge... sexual activity is happening. There's no question about that. And our abstinence only until marriage program is not stopping the sexual activity from happening. So what's occurring is that sexual activity is happening in this vacuum of information, and children are at huge risk. And it just, you know, it's something, it's an enormous health problem. Our young people are at huge risk for all kinds of disease and pregnancy and coercion and many other things that they shouldn't have to face. So I just think it's just incredibly important that we open this discussion.
There are other kinds of sexual activity other than intercourse. Does anyone want to talk about the dangers of engaging in some of those from a health point of view, and also just from, I mean, there are stories about young women being coerced into performing oral sex where the threat of being pregnant isn't so great, but there are other dangers involved in that "if you really love me" kind of thing, you know. Anyone want to comment on that?
Well, I think there's a misconception that, you know, teens have that if you have oral sex that, you know, you're not going to get pregnant and nothing's going to happen to you. But there is that chance of, you know, getting chlamydia or gonorrhea in your mouth. And then also a lot of teens are practicing anal sex. And I think that's the misconception that I'm not going to get pregnant and this isn't sex, and so it's okay for me to do it.
Very interesting comment. Anybody else?
I guess I, from what I've heard about so far at school and such, is that a lot of kids aren't using condoms or dental dams when they're doing anal or oral sex, and that puts them at great risk for all sorts of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. So.
It used to be they said young men were adventurous, and now I think women are catching up. The insurance companies at least say that as far as drivers, their records are getting closer and closer to being as bad as those of young men in terms of taking chances and having accidents. Isn't just the process of growing up and being adventurous part of this? I mean, somebody said my parents didn't know anything. I mean, that's. You know, that's normal, you know.
That's pretty much it, is you're going to try out your own stuff. I know, you know, my mom would, you know, try and tell me, you know, well, this is what you need to do and this is what you don't need to do and this is why. But, you know, we're going to take it upon ourselves to find out and make our own mistakes. You know, you aren't going to learn without making mistakes. You know, it builds character. I have a lot of character.
Well, I think that the process of adolescence, of establishing who you are as a separate person from who your parents define you or who you've, the family that you've grown up in, You're exactly right. Part of the process of that, and I suspect you experience that too, is you engage in risky, adventurous, not well thought out in terms of future consequences behavior. It's part of how you learn to do those things. And again, I think that's a normal part of human development that all of us have gone through or will go through. And so what better way to try to reduce the impact of that, to reduce the consequences, to provide as much information as people can possibly have about, again, the more open the discourse is on that, the better people are going to be able to make informed decisions that take all of those things into account.
Drew mentioned the administration at her school. I'm sure that administration is not different from most public school administrations. Why does that climate exist, do you think, where the less said, the better, the less done, the less we stick our neck out, the better? Is that a problem in the administration or the management of District 2, or is this just something that that exists in our society?
I think it is a societal problem. You know, many people don't want to face the fact that their youth are active in, you know, sexual behavior. I also think that it's not, you know, it's not completely the administrator's fault because they have to follow the orders that they're given, you know, which is given, of course, by school district 2 and the school board, which is given by, you know, the presidential administration. So, you know, you can't just put the blame, you know, on the administrators. I think it's a long chain of people in higher command that are making these decisions.
I do think there's a sense, too, that, you know, we need to be responsible about this. And recognizing that not everyone is going to feel the same way, I think it still needs to come back to the fundamental question is, how do we save our kids' lives? And if someone can find a better way, which I don't believe is abstinence-only programs, that's fine. I don't think anyone is saying there's only one way to do this. But fundamentally, even if people object, the bottom line is, don't we have an obligation to our, you know, the young folks, to the next generation, to save their lives? And if not in public education, where are we going to do that?
Mm-hmm. We have a comment from the audience again.
Drew, as part of the teen board with Intermountain Planned Parenthood, I know that you've had an opportunity to go out and speak with other school districts. And I think it might be good to explain the difference in those school districts where they don't have abstinence only till marriage, what you can talk about, where there are things in District 2 that you can't talk about, and also explain what peer-to-peer education is.
Okay. Through the teen board, I've been able to go and speak to a few medical career classes, which is high school students, about contraception choices. And basically, we just go through and we show each contraception and how it's used, you know, how the percentage of, you know, reduced STI rate, the percentages of reduced pregnancy. And basically, the difference is that we're allowed to talk about contraception use. We're allowed to answer any questions that they may have regarding sexuality. As far as feedback that I've gotten so far, it has been amazing. I've been told that, you know, it really helped them, you know, because they didn't know this kind of information before. And, you know, now they have more options, more choices, more freedom, you know, and so they can make responsible choices for their health. So,
can we wind this up by talking about love? That word means so many things, and it is so terribly commercialized in our culture. I was commenting to my kids the other morning that I think HP is running a commercial now that says corporations love change when they use their products, and there's IBM, or not IBM, but another computer company says that, Microsoft says that our passion is your, you know. The the Deutsche Bank says that they're a passionate bank. The misuse or the careless use of our language, doesn't it cheapen human relationships in the sense that we hear about love, and as somebody suggested, it often is equated with sex. I'm sure that Joe Ripley has a perspective on love from his tradition, but, and I'd like to hear that, but I also am interested in other perspectives that might, what does love mean to you?
Is your thought is how does that connect to sexuality?
Oh, yes. I mean, sex, we talk about sexuality as an expression of love. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should have provided that little introduction. We talk about that as an expression of love or of affection or of other words that we use so that we're confining a certain context as to when and under what circumstances sexuality is all right. And it obviously isn't all right just to go out and use somebody to get off. I mean, that's not loving. So what is loving?
I think being able to be open with somebody and having a mutual respect and truly caring about someone, that's what love is, at least to me.
And that is related to sexuality. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sexuality is just a normal part of expressing that, is it not?
Drew will make her own choices in her life, and they will be good choices. Speaking as an elderly mother, what I wish for her is that she waits to engage in a sexual expression with someone until she has worn her adult skin a little bit longer and feels a little more comfortable in it and has a little bit better sense of what she wants from her own life and what she'd like to do. And that's just plain a mother talking. But I think sometimes maturity is a little helpful in the expression of sexual love.
Joel?
Well, you know, I think sexuality is a is most appropriately expressed as a measure of intimacy, and I think what Drew was saying about sharing and openness and caring, that's why, you know, that's mm-hmm. those are the foundational pieces of intimacy. You know, I think there's some reason to think about that level of intimacy in exclusive relationships, because how you get a profound sense of intimacy is it takes both the duration of time, which I think is what being referred to there, but also you know, a measure of connection. And so, you know, that probably is unsurprising to, you know, to most people.
The greatest of these is love, though, right? I mean,
Yeah, Paul has really had he had some great things to say about that, didn't he?
He also had some dreadful things to say about other things, but I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah, well, we could talk about those too. But even saying that in that case, that the concern for the other person,
yeah,
the how we treat that's the right. other person, is more important for the Apostle Paul than faith or hope.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah,
pretty powerful.
Paige?
I don't know. I think that, you know, the word love has become so twisted, and it's hard to actually, you know, define where it is. I think that, you know, a lot of people will use sex as a way of expressing love, and when you're in a committed relationship, that's great. But other times, they'll say they're making love, but they're really just making a relationship more complicated than it needs to be. And I think, you know, that's just a really tough subject, is,
mm-hmm.
you know, exactly figuring out where
and what love is exactly. So, I don't know.
Well, Molly, we give you the last word.
Oh, great. I think that we are a very emotional society, and we need instant gratification. And so I think a lot of times we are, you know, seeking that. And so love kind of gets twisted, you know, for people, because I think we each have our own meaning of love and what we're searching for. And so I think it's so difficult to define it. And I think love and sex are two different things. And I think we're trying to mesh them together. And, you know, they really aren't supposed to be. They're just two different things.
We don't want people to have sex without love, do we? I'm just curious. Do we really want that?
I don't think so.
So they are related.
I mean, I think they're two different things, but
They
could go hand in hand.
Sure. Well, you all have been magnificent, and I want to thank Molly Hale, who is a case manager and a health educator for the Yellowstone City County Health Department. Thank you for your participation. Dr. Kyle Colling of Montana State University Billings, an assistant professor of rehabilitation and mental health counseling. Paige, who identified herself as an HIV-positive young woman from Billings, a native of Billings. Drew Colling, a senior at Senior High School, a member of the teen board of Intermountain Planned Parenthood. And last and certainly not least, the Reverend Joe Ripley of Mayflower Congregational Church here in Billings. And we also want to thank members of our audience for their participation. This has been co-sponsored tonight. These questions have been co-sponsored in our discussion of these issues by Intermountain Planned Parenthood and Yellowstone Public Radio. We like to partner with organizations in the community that are addressing problems in our society, and in this case, Planned Parenthood certainly is a logical partner. I also want to extend credit and appreciation to our staff that worked on this program tonight, Randy Rocks and Guy Moody for Yellowstone Public Radio, Steve Buck, Jonathan Platt, Lou Shearer, and Scott Dozier for Del Rio Music, providing the sound and the recording tonight. And thank you for listening if you're in the radio audience, and we appreciate it. Have a good night.